The Life Stylist, episode 47, featuring Richard Ennion.
I'm Luke Story, a former celebrity fashion stylist and founder of School of Style. For the past 20 years, I've been relentlessly dedicated to my deepest passion, designing the ultimate lifestyle based on the most powerful principles of health and spirituality. The Life Stylist podcast is a show dedicated to sharing my discoveries and the experts behind them with you. This is your host, Luke Story, coming at you from Hollywood, California, bringing you another transmission of the Life Stylist podcast. Today's guest is my friend, Rich Ennion, and this is part one of a two-part episode where we sit down and have an ancient tea ceremony and talk all things universal truth. So more than an interview, this is really a conversation between two dudes, and you get to be a fly on the wall, and I think we cover some pretty interesting territory. It's quite a fantastic talk, I must say. I really enjoyed actually listening back to it to take notes. I learned a lot from Rich, and I think we had a really good rapport going, so I trust that you're going to enjoy it. So as I said, we sit down for a tea ceremony, which was relatively new to me. It's called Pu'er Tea. And this particular ceremony and this type of tea, known as a show tea, has a very rich and long history. And so Rich explains its origins and how he's integrated that into his life. And then some of the other things we discuss are the similarities between wine culture and tea culture, why the caffeine in tea is less harsh than coffee, and learning to listen to your body and avoiding fad diets, the intelligence of plants and how to use them as medicine, and then how Rich transformed himself from an overweight kid in a small UK village into this super ripped martial arts expert and health and wellness coach, and how the low-fat diet craze almost killed him, how he used a paleo diet and Chinese medicine to rid himself of a cancerous tumor. Pretty incredible story. And then we talk about the myths around the paleo diet and how you might have to actually adapt some of the common conceptions or misconceptions around that eating style. How to live a healthy life without being paranoid and fanatical, something I really needed to hear because I tend to be on the side of paranoia myself sometime. And then the miraculous benefits of Vipassana meditation and how silent spiritual retreats can often bring up your dark shadow side. The dangers of spiritual bypass on the road to enlightenment, how to find value in spiritual lessons, and how karma influences our lives. Building self-awareness around how we use sex and masturbation to avoid facing our problems. How to avoid judging yourself when you make mistakes. And more than anything, we really talk about at the end, the importance of self-forgiveness and forgiveness of others. So I really look forward to bringing you this episode. I'm glad you're here. Don't forget to catch part two this Friday with Rich Ennion. And I'd love to make a request of you, if you wouldn't mind. If you've come back to the show and you're listening over and over again, you've probably heard this before, but if you're new, listen up. The way podcasts work is, in terms of their influence and success and their popularity on iTunes, is all based on iTunes ratings and reviews. So if you dig what I'm doing, if you could go into iTunes and leave me a rating, a 5-star one, obviously, and a review, I would be most grateful. If you don't know how to do that, I made it super simple for you. You can go to lukestory.com/how-to-iTunes-review, and there's a tutorial landing page there that makes it so easy for you. So thank you so much for listening, and again, I'll see you on Friday for part two with Rich. This is Luke, signing out. Rich Ennion is a certified personal trainer and motivational lifestyle expert based in the UK and the United States. He's been traveling the world for 6 years, filming, researching, and interviewing world experts for his web show, RichEats.tv. RichEats.tv has since grown into workshops, motivational talks, and a book he's co-authoring called F Dieting, which he's using to share his passion about freeing people from the dieting trap by connecting them to their body's own innate wisdom. As a former obese teen and cancer survivor, Rich is a powerful living example of personal transformation and brings that body of knowledge to the show today in this two-part interview. Welcome to The Life Stylist, Rich.
Thank you, Luke. Very kind of you to have me on.
Yeah, this is cool. So we're sitting here, you guys, having a tea ceremony, and right now I'm watching Rich. I just clicked record and watching Rich make this fantastic looking tea setup. We're having an actual ceremony, and this is the beginning of the show. We're going to kick it off with some tea. So explain to the listener what exactly you're doing here, man.
Well, I'm just currently breaking up a little bit of the tea, which is the leaves that come in a compressed cake. And the tea is, it's a Chopoer from 2008, this one is.
That means it's a fancy tea.
It's a lovely fancy tea.
Like a show dog, it's a show tea.
Yeah.
And that, okay, cool.
This is going to be a fun one. It's from aged trees. So the trees are at least like 100 years old. You imagine that, these beautiful trees growing on the mountains in China from the region Pu'er. And then 2008, the leaves were plucked from the tree and processed in a very specific way to bring out this lovely tea we're about to drink.
Oh, I'm excited, dude.
Yeah.
it's actually cool because I'm sort of thirsty right now too. So it's like, I can't wait to have that. So this tea business, it's funny, you know, I've done one tea ceremony and I think it was a similar kind of, you know, fancy tea, but it's something I know nothing about. Mm. Does your interest in this have anything to do with the fact that you are clearly British?
Kind of, maybe.
I mean, did you grow up having that? What do you guys have, that like Twillings tea? What's that tea you guys, like that really cheap, you know, like drugstore tea that everyone drinks in the UK?
Well said, drugstore tea. Yeah. So Twinings.
Twinings, okay.
There isn't a link. There is not a link to Twinings in this webpage or whatever this is.
But did you grow up like having your mom like make you tea, and was that part of your culture or not so much?
You know, I did drink some tea. And I remember specifically at my nana's house and my great aunt's house, we would have like a very milky tea. So it was like people call it black tea, but it's not. It's actually red tea in a tea bag. It's powdered. The hot water goes on, the sugar goes in, and then the milk's just poured all over it. And it's just this, for me, just milky nonsense. Some people like it.
Yeah.
I like the ritual of it. I enjoy that. And I enjoy that it's kind of, you know, people sit down, you have a cuppa together. And I guess that perhaps that's why I've taken to it, like this, the ritual of having a cup of tea together. I never really thought about that, actually. Yeah, that's perhaps the...
It's the first thing that comes to mind for me, because I was fascinated when I first started traveling to the UK and I found like, God, this... Everywhere you go, everyone's like, want a cup of tea? Want a cup of tea? I'm like, God, they're obsessed. Like, you don't go to America and everyone's like, hey, want a coffee? Want a coffee? Want a coffee? I was like, oh, okay. This tea is like a whole thing here. Yeah. Okay, so we've got this special tea from this special region. And the way you describe it is like almost like a wine. You know, it's got a year and a region. Just like, you know, you'd have a Chianti from a certain region in Italy or something like that. So... Tell us a little bit more about what's about to go down here.
So exactly as you say, it's very similar to the way wine works. And again, I don't profess to be like the expert in tea. I just
Fair
love
enough.
It and geeked out on this stuff, like really geeked out. I just want to give a little shout out to Global Tea Hut and Wuda, who educated me a lot on this stuff, and also Living Teas. That's okay in the US.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, we'll put it in the show notes. Actually, you know, I think the ceremony I did was from Living Teas.
Ah, there you go.
It was, you know, like a little hippie party in Topanga Canyon in LA. And yeah, I remember that name.
Yeah, good. Good people.
Cool.
Very good tea. So, yeah, it's from a certain region. And this is Pu'er. It's a Chopoer, which means it was, I don't like to use this word, but it's the word that's used, artificially fermented. In that the leaves were plucked. Plucked sounds like we were taking a chicken, and the leaves were slowly taken from the tree, left to dry, piled. And then we say artificially fermented because a batch of the leaves from a previous fermentation are added to the leaves.
Oh, like as a starter culture?
Exactly.
Oh, interesting. That's what I do with my raw goat kefir. I have these little kefir grains and I save them for literally years now.
Yeah.
Then each time I make a new bottle, then I put a little bit of the grains in it, you know, it starts the new little family of fermentation.
Yeah.
Cool.
Just like that. It's just so there's similarities across, right?
Interesting.
Yeah, and that just helps, that speeds up the fermentation process. And that's specific to Chopoers. Chopoers are left on their own to ferment naturally. And then they do some other things. They let it dry, press it into a cake. And
I didn't even know tea was fermented. That's interesting.
Fascinating, right?
Yeah, and it's funny. I don't think a lot of people really consider where tea comes from. I always think of it as like, I don't know, like a tea plant or something. I think of like hemp or something like that. Like, I don't think of a tree growing tea leaves, that it's actually from a tree. And you're like, oh, they pluck it from the tree. So
yeah,
actually comes from a tree. Is that where like your standard black tea, what we call black tea, would come from?
Yes and no. So like in the plantations, when they have like huge farms, they often look like bushes. So in the mind, it can kind of look like a hemp plant, or, you know, taking the leaves from these small shrubs.
Okay, yeah.
But when you leave a tea tree to grow on its own in its natural environment, they can grow into, and do grow into, massive, huge trees with trunks. And they'll grow for hundreds, if not thousands of years.
And wow, that's interesting. How cool.
Like, literally, I think at least 2,500 years old is the oldest tree. It could even be 3,000. I'm not sure, but I'd be quite happy and safe saying it's 2,500 years old, like these oldest trees.
Wow. And is this the same kind of tree then that would produce tea tree oil? Or do you even know?
I don't know. I think so, but I don't know. Is the truth?
Because there's some, you know, obvious spiritual or medicinal kind of quality to this tea that we're about to drink, and that there's like this subculture, I think, of pu'er tea experts and stuff now, because I'm starting to hear a lot about it. But I'm wondering if that specific tree is inherently medicinal, and if that's where they get that oil, which is almost like a turpentine, you know, like tea tree oil. It's a very powerful substance. So.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's a correlation. We will find out.
We will. So I've just served it. I've cleaned the leaves, which basically I just poured a little bit of boiling water on it and rinsed them. And then that was thrown away into a cup that I will feed to a plant later. It's kind of like cannibalism, isn't it?
Yeah. Feed the plant to the plant.
Yeah.
And it's so steamy. I wish you guys could see this right now. Well, yeah. He's putting it on video, so that'll end up somewhere maybe, but it's like hot as hell water. And you know what's really cool that I noticed about that? That's the way that I make my tea water or coffee water, is with a glass kettle.
Yep.
And I just want to mention to people that don't realize this, when you're, it might have something to do with like in tea for the taste, you know, I'm sure. But for me, I learned long ago that most metals that like a tea kettle would be made out of are inferior, and they're amalgam metals, meaning they have nickel and all sorts of really toxic heavy metals that get leached into the water when you boil it. Not to mention plastics. Like here in this room this morning, I used one of those little coffee makers that's made with aluminum and nickel and really bad metals and plastic, which is probably BPA. And that's how I heated up the water for my coffee.
You passed out instantly afterwards.
Yeah. Cause I was just, you know, I was just desperate, but you got to think about what you're boiling your water in, man, because is it going to hurt you to have it once? No, but if you have coffee or tea every single day with some, I'm just going to use your words, some shite cookware, you know, it really, you got to think about, man, that water. And it's such an easy change. You can get one of these glass teapots on Amazon. I think they're like $12 and they're just all glass. They're a bit fragile and takes a little getting used to, because you can't bang them around. They get quite hot. Mm. You can kind of burn your hand. But I love that, you know, our water is pure. And I see that you've used spring water, of course.
Yes, Castle Rock today, actually.
Castle Rock, which comes in glass, so it's all part of the process.
It's a thing. It's quite a big thing. And it's like looking as well to the next step of what happens to, you know, the kettle's made of plastic, or the plastic bottle that the water came in. That plastic ends up in the oceans or somewhere else. There's like this whole line of effect. But yeah, I had a porcelain kettle, but traveling in the last 2 years, I've been to Argentina, to Colombia, here, California, Florida a couple of times, to England, doing like research and writing and interviewing. So I broke my ceramic kettle. I did have a ceramic one.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Well, I just took a drink. When I'm looking down in this, by the way, really beautiful pottery too. It's kind of part of the whole aesthetic experience. But
I made that, by the way.
You did? Oh, yeah. No, really? Are you serious?
I did, yeah. I made all these.
No way, dude. you're a renaissance man, bro. I can't wait to find out more about you. But as I look into this, it literally looks like coffee. I mean, it's such a rich pigment.
Yeah.
So these tannins or whatever. What's going on there?
The deep, dark beverage, this one.
Wow.
Yeah. So chaud pu'er is generally drank after eating, like perhaps after an evening meal or after lunch even.
I wish this was. I'm starving.
You'll be flying after this.
I had a piece of salmon like 3 hours ago between interviews, and I'm like, okay. So carry on.
Yeah, you're going to feel this then, I think. Okay, so on the opposite side of this, which is a darker, more likely to be drank after dinner, is like the green teas and the lighter and the oolongs, which are energetically uplifting. Like a green tea or perhaps an unroasted oolong in the morning to wake up. And I say like uplifting, I mean both from the stimulation side of it, but also tea was initially a medicine before it became this commodity in this...
Before Twinings.
Before, yeah.
What is it? Twinings?
Twinings.
Twinings. Okay, yeah. Good. I got to get that right. I can never remember that word.
Yeah, Twinings. I remember drinking that actually when I was, about 10 years ago, I had this peach-flavored Twinings, and immediately afterwards, I got a headache. This is before I knew anything about tea or this stuff that we're into. And I was like, I got a headache. I don't know why that is. The next day, the same thing. And I was like, oh, it happens after I drink the peach Twinings tea. I stopped drinking the peach Twinings tea, didn't get a headache again after that. So I instantly, just from feeling it, and that's part of the, and we'll probably get into this in a minute, it's part of the information in the book that we give is really getting into the feeling of things and tuning in. It's like, we eat something, do my eyes feel heavy? Do I get a headache? Does my skin change? Is there some sort of subtle change in the body that's giving a signal about maybe don't eat that thing or don't drink that thing?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what my body's telling me right now, having had a few sips of this, is it's going, yes.
Yes.
This is freaking delicious, dude.
It's almost thick, isn't it?
It has such a complex flavor. Hopefully I'm torturing the listener here and you're like going to start craving tea, but it's got a very woody kind of undertone to it. I mean, it really is a complex flavor. It's so good. I'm trying to nail what that flavor is. I know what it is. It's kind of like a buckwheat, almost like a buckwheat flavor. You know what I'm saying?
I had some buckwheat cookies the other day and they were unbelievable.
Yeah.
But I do know what you mean.
It's really, really, really good. Yeah.
This is the interesting thing. Like what we do is, as humans, we like to go, what is that like? What is it like?
Yeah, instead of just letting it be. Yeah, that's the mind. Yeah, that's the monkey mind. Is like, it has to label and categorize everything. It's like, it can't just be a tea. It has to be like this other thing. I mean, people get ridiculous with wine and stuff, right? And even coffee and chocolate and, you know, those substances that we all eat and drink, they'll, you know, have like a 25-word description to explain the nuances of a flavor instead of just allowing it to be.
Yeah.
But it's just like, I don't know. It's a powerful energy here in this cup. It's very cool.
The beauty.
Yeah.
And the thing with it being fermented, it means it's going to be less a stimulant. So there's still going to be a little bit of caffeine in this because that's in the leaf. But because it's been fermented, or even roasted teas, when it's roasted, it burns off some of the caffeine.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. And is it not true, and I don't know if you know the answer to this, but that tea tends to, like if you have a green tea, it has caffeine, but there's different sort of strains or molecules of caffeine, and that tea has a kind of a different balance of those caffeine molecules than coffee, whereas like coffee has just whatever it is, the one strain of caffeine, and it's kind of imbalanced so that you don't, you know, you get more jacked up from coffee. In other words, even though tea could have technically more caffeine. You know what I'm talking about? I don't know the facts, but I've just heard some things like that.
So I haven't actually heard about the different types of caffeine molecule, but that sounds fascinating. But what I have heard and know a little bit about is the other things within the leaf. So we have, like in a coffee bean, there is caffeine. In the tea leaf, there is caffeine. But in the tea leaf, there's also theanine.
Right, L-theanine, yeah.
Yeah, so there's like a balance. They can kind of have like an opposite effect or a complementary effect in that the caffeine will perhaps push, be like the go, 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 go. And the theanine or theanine will be the calming, the more, the slowing down one.
So it has a yin and yang relationship going on.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting, the way nature designs things? It's like the infinite wisdom. Cool. Let's put this tree here, and some knucklehead human's going to figure out to take these leaves. First, they're going to have to figure out how to make fire.
Yeah.
And then they're going to have to come up with some kind of a container that can, you know, you can burn without it lighting on fire. Put water in there, take these leaves, put them in, and we'll have this perfect balance that has, you know, an amazing effect of stimulating, but at the same time, you know, putting a cap on that stimulation with the theanine. It's so interesting how that works.
It's really fascinating.
Like, who was the first knucklehead that was like, hey, that tree looks cool, let's boil those things? I mean, I just find that fascinating. I mean, think about ayahuasca, like the process of putting all those different things together, boiling it up and drinking it. Like, who figured that out? You know, it's like humans get these weird divine downloads of inspiration and they just try something. And the next thing, you know, here we are, you know, however many thousands of years later, having a cup of this.
Yeah, isn't that mad?
It's cool.
The first cup was drank literally thousands and thousands of years ago. Mad. There's something else that popped up for me. Oh, okay, yeah. Just like we were doing then, like, with the, what does it taste like? What does it taste like? And then we're into the, and because it is fascinating, it's really interesting, and it can be really useful to know these things. Like, what does the caffeine do? Which caffeine is it? What does the theanine do? Is the caffeine the same in coffee or is it different in tea? And we love it. And it, like some of the speakers today, so we're at Longevity Now 2016, and I love this conference. Really, really great speakers and good people. And we're here, and there's like these speakers giving this complex information, and I can kind of see, and you can feel the room. I don't know if you notice this, the room's like, what? How? And I think as a speaker, I've done many talks, and I think, okay, this is great information, but there's so much, and they're going so deep into these things, and it's like these people just, they'd probably just benefit from just, you know, organic, wild, and some of the more basic stuff. But I guess it's also a varied audience, so there's going to be people picking up on different
levels. Well, that's we saw Wim Hof speak last night, right? And yeah. Wasn't that his message? When he did the Q&A at the end, people are like, okay, so what's the molecular reaction of the DNA as it hits the cold ice water, and is that related to the ancient Ayurvedic breathing technique of pranayama? And he was just like, shut up, keep it simple, breathe, motherfucker. You know, like, get in the ice. It's just like...
And it sounds like Luke's exaggerating there, but he literally pretty much said, shut up, just breathe. He was like caveman style.
Listen to nature. But you know, I like a balance, because I am an intuitive feeling type person, and I just follow my heart. You know, if my heart says eat bacon, I'm gonna do it regardless of what my head says. If my heart says, you know what, don't eat bacon for a while, go on a green juice fast for a month, I'm gonna do that. It's whatever it is, you know. But I also am fascinated by what makes things tick. And I think I just have one of those kind of brains that I like the why of something too, not just the what. It's like, well, huh, what makes this so magical, energetic, this tea, you know? And on that note, you know, you use the term living teas, right? Mm. So what about the kind of esoteric intelligence or personality of the plant? Isn't that kind of part of this tea culture, why there's a ceremony? And I was like, hey, I want a cup of tea. Yeah. And you just chug it down and run out the door. There really is like a stillness and a presence involved in this process.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Like I said, tea was a medicine before it became this just random beverage to chug down. And there's many different ways of looking at it as a medicine. Thinking about like 1,000-year-old tree on a mountain and thinking it's, or 2,000 or even 100 years old. Like, the wisdom in it. Imagine 1,000-year-old person that was living healthy and well. They're 1,000 years old. They're well. They've been on the planet. They've been drinking the rainwater. A snake came past it, shed its skin. A bird did a poo on it. It took that in or didn't. And all that life and that life force and that energy goes into this living thing, and it's alive. And when a human goes to it and takes the leaves, there's an exchange there. There's life in the leaves. And, you know, in Chinese medicine, in Eastern culture, you know, the word like qi, they call it the qi energy of it. That's the thing with the ceremony, is to sit and be still and to feel it and see if you feel it. See if you feel the qi, see if you feel your own qi moving as you're there. And many people will say, okay, tea is beautiful. Tea is a really amazing leaf, an adaptogen, will do things within the body that the body needs. But it doesn't necessarily have to be tea. If we can sit still and just feel a little bit and feel the people around us and with us as well, that's like a beautiful process of it.
So it's almost like the ceremony, in a sense, is a vehicle by which to just do something with some intention and some presence, right?
Yeah.
It's like, cool, we sit down, we're recording a podcast, but when you bring the tea ceremony into it, there's an element for us to kind of focus on and something for us to do together.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I interviewed someone earlier today, and then he was talking about how we've sort of lost over time, you know, from hunter-gatherer peoples to now, we've in many cultures lost that family connection, you know, from not having meals together and not having these sort of rituals and ceremonies in our lives and in our modern life today. It's like, yeah, you just like cup of tea. Why am I going to sit down and take time? It's like, I'm going to take it in to-go cup, put it in my car, zip through traffic, get somewhere, chug the tea on the way. So I really like things that kind of encourage us to sit down and be present and have something to do with someone too, right?
Yeah, rather than going for a beer or to a pub or to some environment that I'm not particularly fond of.
Yeah.
You want to come for a tea? Like Wednesday night, me and my buddies in Venice, we're going to sit for probably 3 or 4 hours, chat and drink tea.
That's awesome.
Literally, yeah.
Yeah, and you are going to find a different sort of level of consciousness in that environment than you would in a bar. Not that there's anything wrong with going out to a bar and chasing girls and listening to a band and getting wasted, whatever. I mean, that's part of life too for some people. It sounds like maybe, you know, it's something you're, you know, not interested in at this point. I'm definitely not. But I still want to be able to do something. Yeah. You know, it's like you want to get together with people. Well, what are we going to do? Sit around and just sit there? You know? So it's like, it's cool to have some kind of, I guess, a unifying activity or a unifying sort of ceremony that you can get together. And that's cool. So I'm interested in this. You have to invite me to one of your tea parties. That's cool.
You have to come. The Mad Hatter's Tea Party.
That's
have you
awesome.
Seen the latest movie?
No.
I saw it on the fly over here from Bogota. It's just genius. Through the Looking Glass.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I just thought I'd throw that in.
So, oh, cool.
Because they have a tea party in it.
And, oh, cool.
And time is invited or not invited. If you've seen it, you'll know what I mean. But otherwise, like, that movie's pretty strong.
So speaking of Bogota, and I know you spent a lot of time down there, let's travel back a little bit and talk about how you kind of came into doing what you're doing, because I know you travel, you do retreats, you do personal training, you do these ceremonies, like you have a lot going on in different places in the world. So where are you from in the UK anyway, originally?
I'm from a little village called Newton Solney.
Is it anywhere near Manchester?
It depends what near means.
Okay. Because I have a good friend from Manchester, and he has a decidedly different accent from like my Londoner friends.
Yep.
So it's like I thought for a second I detected a little bit of that Manchester accent, but it's not as pronounced as his. So that's what I was wondering.
That's good, actually. You could decipher that as, yeah, he's not from London. He's not from Manchester. He's probably not quite as north as Manchester. It's pretty much bang in the middle.
Okay.
And it's a little village. There's probably more cows than people in that
village.
What's
the nearest city?
Derby.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Derby. And on the other side is Birmingham.
Oh, okay. I've been there. Yeah. I've been to
You've
Birmingham.
Been to Birmingham.
Yeah.
So England is such a fascinating place.
Birmingham, for those listening, I mean, that's the birthplace of Black Sabbath. So it just deserves kudos from there. But when you hear Ozzy talk, he doesn't have a London accent.
No.
He doesn't sound like Mick Jagger. You know what I mean? He has his own whole little accent going on there. So I find that interesting, you know. I think to a lot of people, when you hear a British accent, it's just all a British accent.
Yeah.
But it very much is like in the United States, someone from Alabama is going to have a different accent than someone from Rhode Island, than someone from Kansas, than someone from LA, dude, you know. So it's interesting on that island we call the UK, or, you know, England, at least that part of it, there are these different accents. So anyway, so
it is an island just on that.
Yeah,
note,
yeah.
So my village is here. You drive 20 minutes across to a place like called Warsaw, or just past Warsaw, a little bit further towards Birmingham. And their accent changes to this, and they speak like this, and it's unbelievable because it's only 20 minutes.
That's interesting.
But it's so strong, the difference. It's unbelievable. 20 minutes away.
That's interesting.
Like, what's the change? Is it like the water? Is it the, I don't know what.
I've tripped on that too. Like, for me, the biggest difference is like the accent between, say, New Jersey or even New York or Staten Island and then Boston.
Yeah.
You know, again, to like the casual onlooker, it could sound the same, but if you spend some time with either of them, then you really hear the difference. But it's like, what's the difference? It's like a couple hours apart or something, you know. It's really weird.
Yeah,
so I trip on that too. But anyway, point being is, so now you're kind of this world traveler, vagabond, gypsy, and
the word gypsy keeps coming up so often just lately, and until this year I was thinking, oh my god, I'm a bit of a gypsy.
yeah, which I think is fascinating, because I'm such a, like, I'm kind of a homebody, you know. I've lived in Hollywood 27 years, and like, right. Now I kind of would like to move somewhere a little bit, you know, more remote. And it's terrifying to me, because I'm so accustomed to my lifestyle and my routine. So when I look at someone who's very mobile like you are, it's just so fascinating to me. But so you're a kid that grows up in what you call a village in rural England. How did you get into all of the health stuff and fitness and all these things that you're now doing? Like, when did you bail from there and just kind of like go and start seeing the world?
Few layers on that one. So I was quite an obese kid.
Really?
Although I hid it well.
You guys can't see him right now, but this dude's, we'd say in the UK parlance, he's well fit.
Yeah.
Dude's like ripped. I mean, you can look at his YouTube videos and stuff. He's like, you know, he's, ladies, you'd probably enjoy this if it was on video.
I have a beautiful girlfriend.
Yes, he does. He does. Fantastic.
So at sort of 15, I was a 38 waist.
Holy crap. Inches. Is a 38 the same
fashion,
in the UK?
So you know, yeah.
I know what that means. That's huge. Yeah. I mean, no offense to a guy that's a 38, but at 15 years old, that's big.
Yeah, it is.
And you're, I would say, more of an ectomorph. It's not like you're a rotund kind of, you know, naturally shaped person. So that is definitely a lot of weight.
Yeah. And I was embarrassed by it. Like, I wouldn't show it on the outside. Started playing drums when I was 12 and really got into that. So I was kind of like sat at the back, got my thing. I was playing drums. I felt good. I loved that. Practiced hard. Still play today.
Was you ever playing like rock and roll bands
yeah.
and stuff? Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah.
So I didn't, you mentioned you were a drummer. I didn't know if you like play bongos and do tribal music or if you're like a proper like, you know, jamming to Zeppelin songs or whatever, you know.
So you know, Kit and done quite a few recording sessions, many gigs. Just
oh, cool. Okay.
Love it.
Maybe we'll have the opportunity to jam someday. I'm a bass player.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
sorted. That's funny.
Yeah, right. I did bands for about 15 years, you know, and eventually just, I like playing music. I just don't like playing in a band.
Okay.
You know?
What, the politics of it and the organization?
Just the pain in the ass of it.
Yeah.
You know, the thing I always say, like, playing in a band's great. The only problem is you have to be around musicians.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like going on tour sounds really fun until you're in a freaking van with five other dudes, you know, and then it's like, really? I didn't sign up for this. But anyway, carry on.
So yeah, I mean, I was doing my thing, but inside, deeply insecure. I didn't feel comfortable. Didn't feel particularly comfortable when I was speaking to girls, and it was a thing for me. So I started reading the magazines and started going to the gym, and like I was like, okay, at that time it was fat free was the whole health thing. So I was like, okay, fat is the enemy. Just kind of avoided fat and started running. Well, once I got to the point where I was able to run for like a longer distance. Which was after like many hours in the gym on the bike and like doing little bits of lifting weights. I started to run and then I ran more and more and more and more. And by the time I was 17 or 18, I was running 5 or 6 times a week for 3 to 5 miles, something like that, which, you know, by many standards isn't that much. But for a 17-year-old boy who is just at that time, just I need to not be fat. And he's thinking, I want to feel better. I want to not feel insecure. I want to feel good. I need to do something. But through that, became quite malnourished. I got quite skinny at sort of a turning point at sort of 17 to 18. And going back to do my A-levels, people didn't really recognize me. Like the teachers didn't recognize me that much. I just literally shed a massive amount of weight. And then I was like, hang on a minute. I'm skinny. I got to a 32 waist in that time. Pretty much had a six pack for whatever that's worth, but wasn't particularly healthy at all. And then started looking deeper, and it's like, okay, fat isn't necessarily that bad. Fat's actually quite good. Fat is kind of critical. And just got healthier and healthier. Then got into personal training because I'd learned so much through that. And then went over to Thailand at, I don't know how old I was then, maybe 25, 26. Yeah. And trained Muay Thai. Did like up to six hours a day training Muay Thai for about 6 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was like some of the best days. Like wake up 7 o'clock, train for 2.5 hours, eat, take a nap, train again, take a nap, train, sleep. Just.
So that's quite a movement discipline then to build in. I mean, and definitely something that's different from just going in a gym and pumping iron, you know, however many reps and however much weight, you know, it's like definitely like a very movement centric kind of discipline, right?
Yes. A lot of flexibility, doing a fair bit of yoga, stretching, a lot of massage.
Yeah. Well, like, that's the greatest thing in Thailand. Yeah, you go get a Thai massage in LA. It's like $85 maybe for 90 minutes. You go to Thailand, it's like $20. You know?
Yeah. It's that.
Yeah.
Yeah. We were there all the time. It was good.
Yeah. And so,
But within all this, so within this process, it became quite a thing. Like it was a bit of a thing in my mind. And later on, I actually developed a tumor in my left shoulder, and had a malignant tumor removed. You can see the scar there. There's like a
You got a bit of a crater there.
Yeah.
Wow.
Little beast. And it was like a little kind of grape thing protruding from the surface. The girlfriend at the time, she was like, "What's that?" I was like, "I don't know. I have no idea what that is, but I should perhaps go to the doctors and see because it looks like a lump on my shoulder." So I went to my doctor and I said, "Okay, I have this thing. I wanted you to have a little look and let me know what you think." So he asked me a few questions, did a physical examination, just feeling me all over, put some gloves on, stuck his finger in my bum, had a feel around there.
That's always fun.
Yeah, good day.
And
did you have to pay extra? Was that included in the flat fee?
Yeah. It's actually free in the UK at the minute. And he goes, and I remember it vividly. He goes, well, I don't know. Part of me thinks you should go for a biopsy, and part of me thinks just leave it. And knowing what I know now, having done so much more research and writing the book and all this travel, is like what he said at that moment wasn't particularly that huge, because now I know that if I found anything like that, I wouldn't necessarily go to my normal GP. I would go to an alternative health specialist. That would be my personal decision. But yeah, so I just said, okay, well, if you're not sure, I'm definitely going to have a biopsy and check this out. So it turned out to be a malignant tumor, had 3 operations, and they dug out all the crap and it hadn't spread any further. So I was good. Very, very good. So that was a big learning thing of when the doctor said to me, I'm not sure. And it turned out to be something perhaps more serious. So I'm like, okay. So the magazines and the media they were wrong, because they were saying fat free, fat free, fat free. The doctor didn't quite know what was in my shoulder, yet that turned out to be something more serious than he thought. I got to really take responsibility for this, because the outside people either don't know or don't have my best interest. And then from going more and more deeper into paleo, then out of paleo, like relaxing a lot, learning about Chinese medicine, I feel like I've come to a very happy, balanced place with it now. And I feel like really good about sharing like the information through tea. Like tea I use as kind of my own personal practice, but also as a metaphor to do talks and to share messages with people about connecting with the tree, about connecting with the nature and with people in that.
So it's like your conversation starter / Trojan horse.
Exactly.
It's like, cool, here's something for us to focus on while the real message is delivered of healing and fitness and, you know, the ability to be a sovereign person that takes charge of your own biology, right?
Yeah.
Because I've experienced the same thing. You go to a doctor and they're just like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Take this drug. It's like, that's all you got, you know, and nothing against doctors. I mean, thank God, you know, if I break my leg, please, somebody put a cast on it. But
yes,
in terms of learning about health, you're not going to learn about health from your average allopathic Western doctor. You know, they're not going to ask you, what have you been eating? How's your digestion? You know, let's look at your gut bacteria. Let's do your labs. How are you on magnesium, vitamin D? And you have to go to a totally different kind of functional medicine doctor to get that information, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so that's cool. So then, you look healthy, you know, it seems like you got energy, you got very clear eyes, like you got something going on. So I'm assuming at a certain point, you started to learn and experiment on yourself. You've done these kind of extreme diets and stuff. And then now you're helping people kind of discover that for themselves, right?
Exactly. Yeah. The book that I've co-authored with Jefferson de Perron, who is Ryan Seacrest's personal trainer, is called Bite Me Dieting. It was called Fuck Dieting, which I personally still love.
Don't tell me the publishing company was like, nope.
Yeah, there were other voices within it and other ideas that said, you know, this is perhaps not the best title. And I know this is the best title, but we'll go with this. Okay. So that is from personal experience of being extreme in many ways, like extreme in the exercise, the fat-free, and then also being extreme paleo.
So when you were extreme paleo, what were you eating? I mean, were you just like, cool, 100% meat and fat, or... What do you think was imbalanced about your approach to paleo?
My thinking. That is the key thing that was imbalanced, is my thinking. Thinking that if I only eat meat and some vegetables, I'm going to be fine. And some people can think that way. I mean, you know, you heard these people that smoke 20 cigarettes a day and they live to 100 and they're having a great life. But for whatever, for me, it didn't work. I was just too like breakfast, chicken breast, lunch, salmon steaks, dinner, grass-fed beef, like all the highest quality. But it just didn't work. And if you think about that, it's like, whenever would we have ever been able to eat chicken, fish, and then beef in the same day, even in the same week?
That's an interesting approach. Yeah, I think a lot of people that are on the outskirts of paleo and just dabbling in that concept don't think about what Paleolithic person would have actually had access to. There would have been nuts, there would have been seeds, there would have been plants, there would have been fungi, there would have been insects, there would have been organ meats, right? You definitely wouldn't have 3 filet mignon per day.
No.
Probably, right? So it's like, or like you said, you know, 6 different animals and the rarefied cuts of each animal and all that. So it's interesting to look at it that way.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I avoid diet debates and things like that. And I love the name of your book and I want to go more into that. But it's like... every person is totally unique, right? We're all a snowflake, and what you eat every day maybe not wouldn't work for me and the next guy, and you know, we all have our own kind of needs and approach. But I generally think that what got us to the point where we are in terms of our evolution is probably pretty close to what we should continue to be eating if we can find a clean source of it, you know?
Yeah.
And so,
plus some of the, it's kind of hard to get our heads around a little bit for some people, plus some of the superfoods, because we're not living in the same environment.
Right.
And I used to, when I was in my dogmatic paleo, it was like, no, but they wouldn't have eaten that. They wouldn't have eaten that. It's like, well, yeah, they weren't fucking living next to a power station or a pylon or driving 2 hours a day to work.
Dude, I love that. That's what I always, because I, you know, I'm really big on smart drugs and I take all kinds of herbs and supplements and stuff too. But as much as I'm into following nature, I also do take things that are totally synthetic. Like I love paracetam, aniracetam, modafinil. I mean, all kinds of things that are totally synthetic and don't have anything to do with a natural plant, even as a basis. And people always be like, well, that's not natural. You know, why don't you just be paleo then and, you know, eat what your ancestors ate. And it's like, dude, it's already too late for that. My grandparents were already eating, you know, almost factory farm food. I mean, I'm three generations into not living naturally off the land. You know, the Industrial Revolution happened and I'm a byproduct of that. So there's no way to go back and just be natural. Even if I went and lived in the middle of Alaska somewhere and, you know, lived off bear liver or something. It's like, there's
good luck with that.
there's no being natural anymore. We've gone too far. So to me, it's like you don't have to do anything, but I think personally, at least my own story is to be optimal. Not necessarily that, you know, I suggest everyone has to take smart drugs, but it's like, you know, I sleep in this hotel room and I'm getting, you know, 30 Wi-Fi signals blasted at me. And then my cell phone's charging nearby and there's a clock radio and there's who knows what in the air conditioning system and the mold and this and that. I mean, we're just being inundated with things that never would have happened 15,000 years ago. Yep. So I can't eat what I would have eaten and been able to be, you know, to thrive 15,000 years ago either.
Yep.
You kind of do, I think, to be just really kick ass and be optimal. You've got to hedge your bets a bit and throw in some of the superfoods and up-level what might have been sufficient some time ago.
100% agree for myself.
Yeah.
And it's for people to experiment with it if they want to. It's like, not to be overly paranoid about the environment, but there are crazy, the word crazy is so over the top and dramatic. There's just stuff in the environment that just wasn't there. It's just, that's just the truth.
Yeah. Not to mention the Earth's magnetic field is almost gone.
Right.
Because we're in the middle of a polar shift, right? Or about to approach one. So it's like, actually the magnetic field on the planet is dead. And that's one of the most crucial things for our biology in order to thrive. It just so happens that we're alive at a time when that transition is happening and the poles are reversing. Mm. And so it's just, you know, even if you ground, right? I mean, I was interviewing someone the other day, even if we're grounded and you're out touching, you know, your bare feet to a stone, you're like, oh, great, I'm grounding. It's like you're not even really grounding because there's no magnetic field there anymore. Yeah. And it's rapidly declining. So it's just like, you know,
it's change.
Even if you throw everything, you know, in the kitchen sink at your body and, you know, and use everything you can in terms of your toolkit of wellness, still, you're not going to beat nature, you know? So
it's
an interesting. So what have you found in your many travels to these different countries and experimenting with adaptogenic herbs and superfoods? Like, what did you end up putting in your book and what's working for you in terms of, you know, a diet? I don't want to even use the word diet because I like that you didn't, but what kind of food are you eating? What kind of supplements, you know, what are some things that you feel enthusiastic about?
Well, it's something you said a minute ago, which is a really beautiful way of saying it, is we're like very poetic. We're all a snowflake. And if you've got someone who's preaching a diet to you, whether it's a nutritionist, I don't know if that's the right, maybe your nutritionist probably does know a little bit about you, I'm hoping. But if you've got some guy that's writing a book or preaching to you from a stage saying, you have to eat this, you need to do this, don't eat this, then there are questions to be asked about the things they're saying to you, because we are so unique and that person doesn't know who you are. So in the book, we aim to take people on a journey connecting into the body and outside of the body as well, to the feelings, the messages that the body's giving, like skin. Does your skin change after eating a certain food? Do we, like if I eat too much chocolate, like really, really fucking good chocolate, I might get a couple of spots. Like I have one here probably because of the weekend. I've been eating quite a lot of cacao. And that's my body saying, easy. Okay, you had enough of the best cacao on the planet. Steady.
Ladies and gentlemen, we will now take a brief intermission for the next 3 days and bring you back part two of the Rich Enyan interview this coming Friday. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you're getting a lot of value out of this episode. I personally really enjoyed sitting down for this talk. It was a lot of fun. Rich is a fascinating guy, and we just have so much in common. It was great to really sit down and kind of pick his brain and shoot some ideas back and forth. So if you enjoyed this episode, come back. And more than anything, why don't you just share this with a friend and invite them into the Lifestylist podcast world? It would really mean a lot to me and, of course, to our guests to help get this message out into the world. So screen grab this, share it, forward the emails if you get those. Whatever you got to do to help get this out into the world would be greatly appreciated. See you next time.